Caravan on Saturday, August 29th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup, 9022 North Newman Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Peace.
It's the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan, it's the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts. The Montevilla Jazz Festival showcases the best of Portland-based artists, including the Alan Jones Sextet, the Ed Bennett Quintet, Machete Order, and Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, and many more. Again, that's the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 15th, and Sunday, August 16th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot fail.
This is 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis, K220HR Hood River, K282BH Philomath.
And welcome to the Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Rabia Yaman. Today, I'm so excited to bring you a conversation recorded earlier this month with KBOO volunteer Randall Irwin and author John Shirley. John Shirley was one of the founders of Portland's 1970s punk scene. He is also known as one of the fathers of the cyberpunk genre of writing. He's won numerous writing awards, written screenplays and lyrics for bands like Blue Oyster Cult. Let's listen in on this great conversation, and we'll also be hearing some of John's recent music.
So you've been writing novels where you create the world, the scenario, and you decide the rules, and you now let's imagine that you actually have that power, that what you write in your books happens really in the world. What kind of world are we living in? What technologies and what rules would you have in place?
Well, I wrote a novel called The Other End. It was an alternative apocalypse, an alternative judgment day. Without God in it, really, is more like consciousness itself comes and transforms the world. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole premise for how that would work. It goes with the idea that higher consciousness does correlate to progressivity. I think it does. I mean, 100 years ago, women couldn't vote, you know.
Yeah.
Or 120 years ago, if you like. Chinese couldn't vote. 200 years ago, black people couldn't vote in this country. And things are moving in a general direction, you know, a social evolutionary direction. In a, we go two steps forward and one step back, but we gradually move ahead.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's kind of will sort itself in that direction, but we're going to have a lot of ugly things to react to. We're going to have to go through periods of famine on this planet, I believe, in the second half of the 21st century. But in the 22nd century, to answer your question, I think that we'll learn from those things, and we will learn to create conditions where the population is controlled. And one of the things that's been found that that controls the population innately is empowering women. You know, giving women the vote everywhere, letting them drive, letting them decide who they're going to marry or not marry or never marry. You know, it's just giving women power totally equal with men across the globe will, I believe, diminish the overpopulation, which is a pressure on the environment constantly. And that will help a great deal because women will choose not to, you know, be baby machines. They will choose, many women anyway, will choose to be less breeder and more just creator in the world. And they, some women will choose to have children because it's a grand thing. And I've got three sons. But studies show in the third world that when they have more choice, they have smaller families. And that's an example. You know, knowledge about the downsides of some technology, like coal burning is a kind of technology. It's really creating havoc in parts of China and in our own country, really. I mean, we can't eat fish anymore most of the time without fear of mercury and toxicity, and that is directly from coal burning. It's a weird side effect of coal burning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stuff settles over the seas, gets the fish.
Right.
So as knowledge passes around the world, I think those things will gradually work out, and that people will say, oh yeah, that is making us sick, because look what happened over here. We lost, like, you know, 200 miles square of China here. No one can live there for the next 1,000 years, and you know, and we're struggling with cancer, and because, you know, we're downriver from a place that has all this cancer-causing materials. Eventually, this stuff comes to the fore. So what we'll do is we'll have a society where we decide that if a machine pollutes, it isn't invented. It's only half invented. We haven't finished inventing the machine until it is not a polluting machine, not to any great extent. People will have a totally different attitude about technology. It's not any kind of, like, you know, huggy rainbow sort of environmentalism. It's all practical.
Mm-hmm.
And when people see that it's practical to end pollution and to keep the oceans clean, and to promote a reasonable area for wildlife habitat, which turns out to be good for the air, you know, for example, and just general ecological balance, I believe that's what will come about, and that's what I want. You can have growth without, you know, without cancer, you know, without the technological and social version of cancer, without destruction of habitat.
Right.
In the meantime, we're going to have intermediate devices for getting through this stuff. We're going to have more underground towns and settlements. We're going to have to do a lot of farming in high-rise farming. You know, you know what that is.
Yes.
I've talked about it, and it's starting to be experimented. I was one of the first people, I'm proud to say, to have predicted it. You'll have what now looks like a series of high-rises, you know, making up a skyline, will actually be farms.
Right.
And level on level will be different crops. And they'll control it inside, so there'll be no need for pesticides. So everything will be in its nature, quote, organically raised, unquote.
Right. Beautiful.
You know, it'll be secure from pests. But more important, it'll be secure from air pollutant and from we're going to lose a lot of arable land because of climate change. And we're going to lose a lot of access to food, and that's why we'll need these things. And by the way, there are going to be fish farms that are in the shape of high rises too. And the fish will be going in spirals up migrating as they did in the ocean.
Oh.
Salmon, and they'll think they're migrating in as they did, and you know, they'll go over
right.
the barriers and everything, and they'll get up to the top at a certain time and they'll spawn up there, and you'll have that whole thing within an enclosure where there's no need for the kinds of PCBs and things that get into modern fish farming. Since this goes up, it doesn't take a lot of sprawl.
Right.
So then that'll leave land for green belts. And you've got to spread it out so it doesn't take up too much sunlight. Of course, all these structures will be faced with solar panels.
I want to live in that world. That's the one I want to live in.
Well, it's, you know, I think it'll happen, but we're going to go through a lot of suffering before we get there. But people do learn. There's so many people. We're not going to lose them all. This is not going to work. We're not going to turn into the backdrop for Mad Max. At least the animals will have some place to live. I mean, you know, it's not going to be an endless wasteland. We're going to have pockets where we've damaged things, and we're going to have a horrendous storm proclivity in many parts of the world. I have some stories, one coming in analog, about areas where that I call stormland, where it's storms 24/7, 365 days a year as a result of climate change. But eventually that will wear down.
Beautiful. So you say this is coming out in Analog Magazine? This is a story that you've written?
Yeah. See, I can be scientific sometimes. It's true. I tend to walk the line and be a little, you know, more into the kind of human and social consequences of things and the feel of the culture in the future. But I do my research. And
no, that's very clear that you do. You have
I've predicted some things. And this is an analog in, I think, early next year. Analog Magazine is a story I have about a novelette called Cory for Coriolis.
Great title. Yeah. So, yeah, in terms of your work of late, your writing work, I mean, primarily you're known as a science fiction, science fantasy, cyberpunk, and then later on splatterpunk kind of an author. But in recent years, you've written things that are completely out of that world in some ways. I love this idea that, you've passed over on the other side. There's still a higher place to go. It's always this constant moving upwards and onwards and things.
Oh, well, yeah, there's a theme of transcendence and this idea that there's usually hope. I mean, in my stories, like in Black Butterflies, that won the Bram Stoker Award, that book.
Yes.
And it's very dark stories of set in the kind of gritty real world and in a supernatural kind of backdrop. I tended to go for the darkest of the dark, but I also show the human side of darkness, kind of in a Jungian sense. And to me, it was Carl Jung said that we only know a tiny little spot on the sphere of our being. So it was an exploration of my dark side. But eventually, by the end of the book, I finally, you know, have a transcendent moment where people escape from it. It's something that, it's in my nature to look for. I just chose sides, and I chose the side of hope, I guess. So when, you know, even though things get really dark and scary in A Song Called Youth, the cyberpunk book, the good guys triumph in the end without any kind of resort to cliche good guys, but still the general trend of, you know, people being more evolved triumphs in the end.
It's not called a song called Death Trilogy. It's a song called Youth Trilogy. So there's already a clue there.
Youth is a constant renewal, right? So in my novel Demons, in which the world is invaded by demons, largely giant demons, really peculiar, bizarre demons, that just seems like an endless horror in a way. And yet there's a thread of people finding a way past it and dismissing the demons. You know, I don't believe in the supernatural per se. It's the social allegory, and it has to do with the, you know, industrialists who summon these creatures inadvertently. And I won't go into the whole thing and give it away, but really I look for a way to say what I want to say in any given genre. So if I write Doyle After Death, which is about the afterlife, and I don't know if there is one, but if there is one, I figure it has to be a natural afterlife, not a supernatural one. Like, it has to have its own ecology, its own physics. So I tried to figure out how one would work. how it would really come about and what it would be like. And I would assume that it had its darkness too. And in fact, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, works together with a recently expired detective from Las Vegas who becomes kind of his Watson, you know?
Yeah.
And they
kind of a sleazy little street detective, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And so it's sort of his arc of self-discovery, too. And they solve a murder in the afterlife. And part of the interest is how can you have a murder in the afterlife?
You have been writing novels and stories since at least the mid-70s. I think you wrote your first novel was in 73 or so. Published a couple years later, or
I wrote my first novel when I was 18,
yes.
and it did not get published for a few years, but eventually, with a little revision, it did get published. And it was around it was earlier. Let's see, it was the late 60s, I guess, 1969 or something. And then I published my first book. It was published by Zebra in I think 1972.
Yeah.
The Transmaniacon, which was the title and borrowed from Blue Oyster Cult song. First album.
Yeah, well, so here's my question. Those first manuscripts, now, how were those produced? I'm talking about technologically. Were those pencil to paper and handed into a publisher? Was that, did you actually have a typewriter and did you type those up?
It was late enough in the century that you couldn't really hand a handwritten thing into the publisher, but a lot of people, even now, people will handwrite their things out and then type them up. It was typed on a manual typewriter with lots of crossouts and a liberal use of correction fluid. But it was a cheap manual typewriter. And then eventually, I got really high tech and went into Brother Electric typewriters. And I thought it was like the very 21st century when the IBM Selectric came out with a little whirling ball, you know.
Yeah.
I got one of those. But as time went on, I got a little word processor that looked like something from a submarine, and it's showing like a sonar image or something. That's what it looked like. And I remember Robert Silverberg, the Science Fiction Writers of America magazine, laughing at writers still using typewriters, saying because of the speed with which he can move blocks of text around and erase things, he'll be able to write four books to their one. And it's true. It's like the whole process changed, and it changes in your mind. Like things flow differently in your mind than if you're typing on a standard typewriter. Than when you're working on a computer, it's more fluid and sometimes it's better in some ways, but on the other hand, I'm not sure that people think out their writing as much as they used to, because you had time to do it with the other forms. So it's a mixed bag, you know. Like everything, it sort of extends to all technology. All technology is a mixed bag. This wonderful advantage to the internet and gigantic downsides to it. I'm sure people, though, reacted to typewriters when they first came around. It's like, you know, there were probably people who sneered at them, and that's not a way to write. You know, that we lose the fluency of writing with the quill and the ink, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, the texture of pen on paper or something.
Yes. Well, there's something to be said for that, but you know, I do everything on a computer. I even write poetry on a computer and lyrics and everything. Although occasionally I'll write a bit of a lyric if I'm thinking of lyrics on my forearm, because that's what's available.
Now that's the John Shirley I remember from the late 70s punk scene in Portland. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, napkins late at night with coffee stains in Denny's or something. You know, lyrics famously are written on things like that.
Well, and especially I'm thinking of in terms of someone like yourself who has been writing about the future or alternative realities where there is this sort of this strange interaction between humans and technology, where the lines between them become blurred, and as you said, with cyberpunk, which I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but you are considered to be the father of cyberpunk.
I think I'm probably the great uncle, the embarrassing great uncle.
Yeah.
gets drunk at Thanksgiving. I did actually come out of the punk scene, but, you know, people like Bruce Sterling and Rudy Rucker had a liking for it, and they went to punk rock shows. But the punk part of cyberpunk is really it's hard to find exactly the source of it, the root of it anymore, but punk rock was a kind of street rock. You know, it was like it's rock that could arise from the street. You could make it in your garage, and you could have a show in your garage. And it was garage rock, yes, but it went another step. It's very hammering directness, you know. And people who would normally have been excluded from it because of the limitations of their musical capability were suddenly able to do it. And, I mean, a lot of them were good musicians, too, and became good musicians. But really it was a sort of almost shamanistic or primitive music outpouring. A modern primitive, if you like, and that it allowed people to express something that, you know, those people, the street people and people and disaffected people and alienated people, you know, all they needed was a cheap microphone and a guitar. We used to plug them into guitar amps because that was easier than getting a PA.
Yeah.
And, you know, a guitar you could buy at Sears. I mean, the crappier it sounded, the more appropriate often the guitar. And a cheap drum set. And then pretty soon it was, you learned some Ramones songs and then design your own. And punk rock was from the street level, and cyberpunk, the idea is like what the uses that the street has for technology. So it's kind of the technological variation of that in a way to me. It's the street and perhaps the poor and the disenfranchised taking technology and turning it to their own uses, and sometimes subversively, sometimes acquisitively, but they're, you know, making things happen for them that are normally denied them because they've got these skills. And they, you know, I have a son, my youngest son is a sort of tech miner, in that I don't mean he uses tech to mine, I mean he mines tech.
Yeah.
He he's the kind of guy who goes to garage sales and whatever and finds outdated tech or just pieces of, you know, valuable tech and then reconnects them and puts them together, and he puts things back together and sells them on eBay.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's a very cyberpunk thing to do.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that when I look back at the DIY sort of mentality, we can do this. In a way, it's just another version of the digital divide notion, and that is before, if we wanted to make music, we needed it was expensive, and we needed access to expensive studios, for example, or we needed an auditorium with proper sound. And then suddenly, it's like, well, no, we don't actually. We can buy that guitar from Sears. We can play everything through that cheap amp that came with our guitar kit, and we can play it in the basement of a house or my dad's warehouse or something. And suddenly there's this empowerment, and there's this sense of,
yeah. And you just make it happen. And before you were not empowered to make much happen. But suddenly there's a scene. You can create a scene, and people need to be able to do that now too. By the way, there's an account for you Portlandites by Mark Sten. Have you seen the book, All Ages, The Rise and Fall of Portland Punk Rock? It's this great book that Mark Sten, who was like deeply involved in all of it, has come up with, from giving an account from like 77 to 81, and when it was like the first wave of it. And he and I together created the first Portland, Oregon punk rock nightclub called The Revenge.
The Revenge
Before
Club.
Before the Satyricon.
Yeah.
Before the Satyricon, yeah. And we rented halls from bikers, and we put on shows, and we just put up flyers, and people showed up, and it was very, very impromptu, but we made it work, and we created this scene, and bands like the Neo Boys, one of the very first all-women punk bands, maybe the first was the Runaways, but after them, I think it may have been the Neo Boys. They're kind of an art band, too, and they were there, and later on the Wipers, my own early bands, and then Sado Nation, where I was lead singer of that for quite a while, and then I left. They brought on a lady to do it. But, you know, all these bands formed around that little nexus of people like Mark Stanton and
yourself.
Myself and Dee Dee Moran and Mike King. And Mike King did a lot of the artwork. A lot of people did all of the above, you know. They were in bands and they did underground art, and sometimes they did sketchy things on the street to make a living, but it was all part of the culture.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mark Sten has this great book called All Ages, and it's full of photographs of these scenes. And I'm not saying this just because there's a chapter on me. And people like Jim Chase, who...
Jim.
Subject of the film Alien Boy, was later killed by Portland area police officers for... being afraid of them. I mean, basically, they killed him for being afraid of them. They beat him up until he died. He was in a band.
Yeah.
And
made one of the best fanzines that we had at the time.
Right. And there are a lot of great fanzines, too. That people put them together just as, you know, impromptu as they did bands. And it was another empowering thing. Suddenly, you know, you had a little magazine, and you could just staple it together, basically. You could photocopy it.
I'm actually holding a copy of that very same book that you're speaking of right now in my hand. It's an amazing book. In fact, I have here. This is the description of you that I pulled from the book that I was curious about your reaction to. May I?
Yeah.
So it says that he stood out in Portland's low-key poetry open mic performance art scene because of his naked dynamism and flamboyant theatricality. Lacking any inhibiting humility or sense of shame, he left the distinct impression that there was no place he wouldn't go if the spirit moved him. John just would not take no for an answer. If people took offense, he laughed at their insults, spit into their wounds, and plunged onward. It's no accident that the hero of his first novel held the job of the world's foremost professional irritant.
Mountain of Skulls by John Shirley. We're listening to an intimate conversation with volunteer, KBOO volunteer Randall Irwin and early punk pioneer John Shirley.
Now, has he actually captured...
I'm not objective, but that's probably about right. In fact, I think you can say that a lot of the Portland punk scene started out as poetry slams of a kind, which the term wasn't around then, but that's what it was.
Right.
And people would get up and just declaim, and then I kept trying to introduce a musical element. And you know who else started that way much more successfully? Patti Smith. She did exactly the same thing. She added a guitarist, but you can really hear it on her first album, Horses. So I was trying to do something like that, and eventually, you know, organized bands. But in between, I just had people do just a guitarist doing a sort of very rhythmic thing, and sometimes I would give people spoons and tell them to bang their glasses in the bar rhythmically.
Right,
and then I would do something based on that. And I remember once I got really worked up, and I was dancing as I was doing this and shouting, rhyming poetry, and which was a lyric about somebody somebody surfing a runaway bus in Portland. The bus had, like, the bus driver had died, and this guy was surfing it down the hill somehow.
Yeah.
So I jumped on this table that these people were sitting at in the front, and it broke. And the ladies were appalled. There were two ladies there, and of course I had to pick theirs. And I remember when I was with Sado Nation, the Monitors, there was a Christmas tree set up to the right of the stage because it was New Year's Eve, and to the music, I kind of like rode it around the room, and of course it left a trail of broken Christmas tree ornaments and.
Yeah.
And so I was living it as much as I could. And, you know, I got in trouble and I got sick sometimes, and sometimes I overdid things. But I was right in the middle of this wonderful scene with a lot of other great people. You know, Eva Lake was there, and she's still around as a painter and an artist. And it's a part of Portland culture that a lot of people now aren't aware of. They're aware of the Satyricon place and that kind of second wave of grungy punk rock, but they aren't aware of this.
Yeah, and no, it's an interesting slice of that period of time in Portland, to be sure. Now, you've been writing about the future and alternate scenarios of the universe since the mid-70s, and now looking back, here we are 40 years later. Can you compare today's world with the world you were describing? Are there things that have happened that you didn't expect to happen in your lifetime? Are there things that haven't happened yet that you are surprised haven't happened?
No, it's mostly stuff that I didn't think would happen so soon. And it's funny, you know, when you read science fiction novels, including some of mine, you know, they're set in the far future year of 2008 or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, people put on their giant hologram projectors so that they can walk around appearing to be giants or whatever.
Right.
That isn't just going to happen with science fiction, but there are a lot of things that interest me and excite me and concern me all at once, and that's in the nature of things. There is this huge gap in the access to technology for some people, and sometimes it's more obvious than other times. I mean, you'll find almost everybody has a cell phone. You can go to some village in Southeast Asia, like a remote village, and there's still people with cell phones often, as they herd goats even. But I especially biotechnology is the great one that you will see a real contrast between access by the poor and even the middle class and the 1%. The 1% is going to get rejuvenation, and most of us aren't. I think there will be rejuvenation to a large extent, and most of us won't be able to afford it.
Well, yeah, I'd like to follow up with that a little bit. You've talked I think it was your TEDx talk. Well, you've spoken about the false singularity versus the real singularity, for example, and this notion, this fear of death-driven notion of wanting to live forever by bonding with technology and becoming one versus forming a more collaborative and empowering relationship with technology and using it to move forward, greater computing power, for example. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, some people think that there's going to be this singularity I call it false singularity. They think it'll be between the year 2035, 2045, somewhere in there. And in their minds, it's magical thinking, really. Psychologically, it's a supernatural event for them because it involves, amongst other things, a technologically achieved eternal life. Not just, you know, through biotechnology, they think they're going to download their minds into a computer and mm-hmm. they'll live forever. Or you'll be in something like, if you saw the movie Ex Machina, it's a good movie, good representation of the kind of technology they're talking about. And they're going to use this matrix, this sort of framework of the AI as the vehicle for their immortality, they imagine.
Right.
even if you manage to have a copy of some personality modalities and maybe in a vague sort of way some memories put on a computer, how is that you? Is a photograph of you you? It's like a three-dimensional cerebral image, and it's not really going to have the holographic or this sort of enigmatic central core that is a human being that we don't really understand, the nature of consciousness, what is that?
Right.
It's not going to have that. It's just going to be this sort of soulless reproduction at best. And I don't think it'll even be a very good one. It's not like they're going to die and then suddenly come back to life in this thing and say, oh, I'm here in the machine. No, I don't believe that it's ever going to happen. There's an infinite gap between two. That's baloney.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the human mind and brain and consciousness is way more complex and more a whole that's more than the sum of the parts.
Right.
Than they're giving it credit for.
So then how would you characterize, what is the real singularity that the human race is facing?
It's basically just a fantastically increased level of interaction with technology where the things become almost instantaneous. And it's in terms of desire and the production of what you want to convey or learn about or find out about. The Internet of Things, you've heard this expression, you know?
Yes.
So that objects around you will have access to this vast Wi-Fi network and be able to anticipate what you want, or you just tell them what you want, and they can't materialize it exactly like the things in those devices in Star Trek, you know. Although to some extent, mm-hmm. now that we have 3D printers, and if they become more financially feasible, that can produce some of that effect where you just say, you will be able to say to your 3D printer, can you make me this pair of shoes? Mm-hmm, and it right. will be able to do it. So, as long as you have it loaded with the materials that it builds from.
Right.
And that's going to cost money, and the device itself will. But, computers originally were very expensive. And
it's probably more powerful than what NASA was using 40 years ago. You touched on AI a little bit. What are your feelings with regard to artificial intelligence? There's a lot of stuff out there with very famous people in the science and science fiction and philosophy realms saying that it's going to be great, that it's going to be the end of humankind and everything in between. Do you have a position with regard to artificial intelligence and its use?
Well, as dramatized in Ex Machina,
mm-hmm.
talking about the movie, not the comic book,
yeah.
different thing, the Turing test will be a kind of watershed to know whether or not an AI is really an AI, an apparent AI. I mean, we use the term even now for the AI of a program, or especially in video gaming, they use it. The AI of this video game character is very good or not very good. But true AI has to pass the Turing test to show a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior.
Right.
So they can't tell it from a human being, you know, at a distance. I mean, if you were talking on the phone with it, you wouldn't know the difference. And it's not just the quality of the voice, because that's already coming. We're already getting robotic voices on the phone that
right.
are harder and harder to tell from a human, and just in terms of intonation. And it's more like a response. How responsive are they? How many associations do they have, and how can they organize them into a coherent, compressed sort of response so that you know, it's not going to go on and on with all its different associative, connections. It's going to respond like a human being.
So that's why in your TEDx talk, for example, when we talked about the real singularity and being this greater cooperation between human beings and massively improved computing power. And so I wondered, so are you talking about basically an artificial intelligence kind of a system that works with and surrounds human activity? And how do you see that? Like, what is the relationship between humans and technology that is ideal in your future versus some of the horrifying things you've written about in your books?
Well, of course, I don't think that the Terminator scenario is going to happen. I don't see why an artificial intelligence would have to necessarily evolve into something that's going to be hostile to us. You'd have to program it that way. Now, the danger, you know, we shouldn't forget that human beings are really not all that free thinking, and we don't have as much free will as we think we do. We are pretty mechanical in our responses too. And they always made a big deal in Star Trek and in other movies about the humanness and how, you know, the machine or some alien that doesn't have a body exactly, just the floating energy system or something, doesn't have that humanness that makes them special. And but I think that we are pretty mechanical. But there is this core thing, as I hinted before, that makes us somewhat distinct, and it can be developed in people. You know, this kind of core consciousness can be developed to grow in people so they can become less mechanical and freer. So anything that encourages that, people's, you know, freedom of development, and I think is good. And I don't think you'll ever see that kind of like three and four dimensional growth in an artificial intelligence. I think that they'll always be believable, but ultimately they'll miss that one thing that we do have secretly down inside us. And also, I don't think that they have to ever be hostile unless we program them that way. I suppose people are thinking of self-programming artificial intelligence, and that's what they hint at in these different films and stories. But yeah, that can happen up to a point. But there's no reason to develop them in a way that leaves them aloof from our being able to constantly put input, you know, restraints on them, and the Asimov's basic laws of robotics and so on. I just don't see why that should not always be a part of our development of an AI. And I think people are, you know what I think they're doing? I think they're superimposing human nature. They're anthropomorphizing AIs when they think that they're going to turn evil. They're seeing human evil, and they're projecting it on AI.
There you go.
I don't think there has to be any, except that as human beings misuse them. We misuse every technology, just about.
Yes.
You know, we're misusing cell phones a lot of the time, not you and me, but people walking down the street or staring into them and bouncing off telephone posts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and ignoring one another and staring into them in the park and ignoring their children who are trying to talk to them. And, you know, we misuse technology every day in different ways. You know, we misuse it in the creation of certain weapons. I mean, I'm not saying we don't need any weapons ever, but we're going to be creating more and more intelligent drones. And if you're worried about the drones we have now that are firing missiles because other people tell them to at a distance, remote controlled, that's just the tip of the creative iceberg. And, you know, when it comes to drone development, they're going to be amazingly flexible in the future. They're going to be able to open a window and fly through it. Some really small ones will be able to fly through cracks in the wall and follow you around. And probably that fly in the room with you right now is just a fly. But
well, that's a Johnny paranoid right there.
In 30 years, you might not be able to be certain of that. So there, you know, people abuse technology. They use it blindly because sometimes in the service of their own ambitions, and that's why we get things like microbeads introduced into the environment. The stuff just make toothpaste creamier, and so these, you know, we have this microbead pollution, and they just tossed this stuff in with barely any approval process, and now it's turning out to be a huge problem. It's in animals all down the food chain, and it's being banned in various places, but it's causing problems in people's brains, conceivably.
Yeah.
And it's just an example of, you know, if we rush technology into development, if we rush it into production, it is, sometimes it's wonderful, but it's risky. It's like what we did with nuclear power. There were great advantages to it, but they didn't think every aspect of it through. They didn't think, you know, how to deal with the waste really far enough. And ambition and greed pushed them into ignoring those problems and just putting them aside, just so they could, you know, take the next step. And
yeah.
And so as long as we have that tendency, technology is going to present as many risks as advantages, and it's something we have to survive as a race. We have to make sure we don't destroy ourselves with it. At the same time, and I'm not a Luddite, I'm just saying use it intelligently.
Yeah, it is a good point. And if you think, if we can also just keep in mind that technology is nothing more than a tool, it may be an increasingly powerful tool, but it's a tool, and it can be used for good, and it can be used for what many perceive as bad. And so, yes, an intelligent use of this tool is preferred over, like you said, one that is governed by greed and the desire for power.
You can have your capitalist motivation, but you've got to balance it with, you know, the right hand has to be balanced with the left hand. You have to balance it with a constant checkup on the ramifications of it, and say, well, no, we can't do that because that would pollute the air egregiously. So let's try this instead with it, and take a little longer for the production process for technology. That has to be part of our culture, and it's not part of our culture. We have a little bit, you know, with the FDA and the EPA, but there's very little control over how technology grows.
Right. Yeah. Along that's kind of a similar line. So you referenced there earlier this difference between an intelligent collaboration with technology versus the risk of this mindless dependence on technology. And I'm interested in that. We hear that a lot, people talking about faces buried in phones or tablets. I wonder where are the science fiction novels from previous generations where they complained about the negative consequences for society with all the young people and their faces buried in books and newspapers and crossword puzzles on the bus and fiddling with their pocket calendars and the way they do, and we're doomed.
Probably they were there. You know, mm-hmm. People were probably commenting sardonically about them. There's definitely a fuddy-duddy quotient in all this, and one doesn't want to be a fuddy-duddy or a Luddite. It's just about the intelligent use as opposed to blind use of a thing, and intelligent productivity in technology as opposed to just blindly producing.
Well, can you imagine some of the books that you wrote, say, in the late 70s or throughout the 80s, science fiction stories about dystopian futures? And had you included scenes where people were mindlessly interacting with their technology and ignoring the story around them, what a fascinating and prescient but at the time people would say, what the hell is this? What is he even talking about?
It's true that there are all kinds of things happening right now that were not envisaged. Although, you know, people like Arthur Clarke and to some extent Asimov and a few others.
Yeah.
I think Frederick Pohl and C.J. Cornbluth envisioned sort of the commerce environment, the electronic commerce environment that we find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And we identify with what we wear. I mean, there were always fashions, but we identify with, you know, what soda we drink. Are you a Pepsi or a Coca-Cola drinker, or do you, or are you somebody who buys a special one at Whole Foods? You know, our identities are all tied up in what we consume, and it's just part of the world now so much, and people aren't even aware of how much that's taken over.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting that the authors that you mentioned, you referred to there, at least in my feeling of those authors, is that they come from a stronger scientific background or a scientific approach to science fiction, with of course a healthy dose of social commentary. Whereas I find that a lot of your work, and you may argue this, it feels like it comes more from a human perspective and some. And there's a lot of positivity in your stories. There's in the end that the human race is going to battle on and it's going to survive some of these things, unless of course we're talking about the macro being just deciding that we're all idiots and squashing us out of existence. But
well, yeah, that was just one gets in a bad mood when writing stories sometimes.
I love that one though. I love that one. I can't say the title because this is going out during the daytime.
But no, you can't say the title. It's in In Extremis, the book In Extremis.
Yeah.
First story, but yeah, it's this giant being, kind of a giant amoebic thing, comes to Earth and discovers that people are, it just sees all this, the worst of us, and said, no, we really, the kindest thing to do is just expunge them on the instant and wipe them out, and it'll be a peaceful world at last. Well, you know, one gets in those moods because you look out at the world and you see ISIS and you see people reacting to ISIS and blowing up civilians. Both are bad things. You know, you see medieval behavior in the Middle East and medieval behavior in Alabama. It gets daunting. So, there are some stories that are reactive. Some of my stories where I try to show, as we discussed before, how technology can be empowering. So in a song called Youth Trilogy, the Cyberpunk Trilogy, you have an underground of people reacting to a neo-fascism. They're limited in their resources, so they use street technology and other kinds of technology to communicate. And it was a little bit in anticipation of things like the Arab Spring, which kind of didn't work, didn't sustain. The Arab Spring didn't sustain as well as some people hoped, but it was still impressive and almost miraculous how people used social media to spur a revolution in Egypt and Tunisia. And then the people with the guns kind of came and took power back. But there's always going to be pushback, and then we'll have to think of something else. But it was a big infusion of hope. That is not forgotten. People remember, when suddenly we were powerful. You know, suddenly the people were powerful. So then they start thinking about other ways that they might use this interlinked technology to go around the guys with the guns.
Yeah.
You know, MoveOn.org kind of did that to get Obama elected. And I don't necessarily agree with everything the president has done, but I think he's basically a good guy. And they were, a very empowering thing in the USA in 2008. You know, now then Citizen United came along maybe as a sort of response to MoveOn.org and organizations like that. So then there's always pushback. So now we have to find a way, legally through the courts and through new innovations and how people can communicate freely through technology. I mean, there's the internet, but there is going to be a sort of specialized Wi-Fi internet, maybe bouncing off the ionosphere, let's say, through a sort of crowdsourcing of power sources that people will be able to use. Here in San Francisco, there's a company that is the alternative Wi-Fi company. Rudy Rucker's son, Rudy Rucker Jr., actually runs this company.
Oh.
He puts up little Wi-Fi antennas on roofs, through arrangement throughout the San Francisco area, and he's built this up and And it has access to the internet, but also has its own corner of things that people can use. You know, it's just one example that every time they push back, we can push back in our own way. And the multiplicity of the pushback with the greater number of people eventually is a way that overcomes the 1%. You know, translating the 99% into technological expression, and then has its own drawbacks, and people are various, and people misuse the internet, and they'll misuse these things. There are a lot of conspiracy theory sites that are just distracting people with a horse pucky, but still, people have an ability to recognize truth if they really try. The majority of people do, and you know, they have the capability of catching the verisimilitude of a thing. And eventually, enough truth keeps passing back and forth in this kind of wave over the globe. People recognize it. And there's a lot of hope in that. So that's where I'm thinking things are going.
Hey, listen, I really, really appreciate you being willing to speak with me. And it's great to talk to you. And it was wonderful reading that the Mark Sten book and thinking back to those early days in the scene. You know, I loved it when... You know, you'd be up there on stage, John Shirley and the monitors or something, and then you'd hop off and Smegma would get up there and you would be like the keenest audience member after having just come off stage and blowing everyone away with your energetic performance. And then you'd jump down and in your true fashion, you would be going around the room urging people to go up and you know, get on stage and take those instruments that are sitting there. You know, they're walking off and leaving them for you to play. Get up and play. Let's do it. We're all in this together. It was a wonderful... you were like this magic.
That was the concept. We were trying to live it.
And yeah.
I should have mentioned Smegma. That band, you know, it's a kind of amorphous thing, and people come and go. But the concept of it and the guiding leadership in that, Bradford Hotstetler and people like that, it's still out there. And
amazing.
You know, they were an inspiration for bands like The Residents, actually,
mm-hmm.
and Negative Land. I mean, they were... and kind of in the Zappa Beefheart arena too, and that was always something I loved, as well as punk rock,
yeah.
You know, alternative forms of rock. You know, that we had that also. Yeah, I put out albums; they're out there. In fact, I have a new one. I should have mentioned this, brought out by Black October Records. Yeah, it's called Broken Mirror Glass, the collection.
And yeah, it's amazing.
A collection of stuff from like. Two of my Satanation songs, and then material from my futuristic funk era and other eras, and as recently as stuff recorded in 2012. And the Black October Records is a German label, but they've brought it out over here. It's on iTunes and so on. I think they're offering it on Bandcamp now.
In closing, let me thank you very, very much for speaking with us here on The Digital Divide. And if people want to learn more about, if they want to follow you and your activities and learn more about what you are doing and have done, is there a website or a place that they can go to get more information?
Well, if they Google me, they'll come to it. But there is the website that some fans created, john-shirley.com. It's that simple. And there's a blog, too. You just John Shirley blog, you'll come to that. And there I am on Facebook, too. People can talk to me there.
Excellent. And is Dark Echo still a viable website for information regarding your activities?
Yeah, darkecho.com/John Shirley. It's the same one as the John-Shirley.
Shirley. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you.
And we've been listening to an interview between KBOO volunteer Randall Irwin and author, musician, all-around Renaissance man, John Shirley. We're going to go out with a little music by John Shirley and then noon headlines. And moving on, coming up after that. So keep your radio turned on. Radio keep you turned on. And be sure and listen to Digital Divide every second Friday of the month on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.